From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Today, for the first time in 4 years, Tour de France spectators will have the opportunity to cheer on sentimental favorite Lance Armstrong. That's just ahead on Only a Game. Also, Bud Collins helps, albeit figuratively, to raise the roof at Wimbledon, and we'll examine how sports coverage has been affected by the downsizing and elimination of some of the nation's newspapers. Also ahead, chasing the monster stripers with Long Island's Billy the Greek.
Because he's a pain in the ass, and because he's an arrogant guy at times, and because he lies like a rug, some people resent him. A lot of people think he exaggerates, that it's not humanly possible to produce the numbers of fish that he does. I would think he's full of crap, too, if I didn't see it with my own eyes.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The good news about the 2009 Tour de France and the world of competitive cycling in general is the recent introduction of the so-called Biological Passport Program, an ambitious testing regimen designed to catch riders who try to cheat. How could the institution of such a program fail to discourage riders from attempting to enhance their performances by detectable means? The bad news is that one of the guys who was expected to ride in the race that begins today got caught for previously using EPO, traditionally one of the enhancers of choice in the cycling community. As a result, Dutch rider Thomas Dekker has been tossed from the race and suspended by his team, Silence Lotto. Besides Lance Armstrong, who has come out of retirement, a handful of highly regarded U.S. riders will be competing in this year's tour, which will begin today in Monaco and eventually dip into Spain before finishing in Paris on July 26th. Christian Vandeveld, who suffered a broken rib, broken back, and broken pelvis in a crash during the Giro d'Italia earlier this season, is among those Americans, as are Levi Leipheimer, who's riding for Astana, the same team employing Armstrong, and George Hincapie, who spent years helping Armstrong to win the race. This time around, he'll be trying to beat Lance and everybody else, but mostly Lance. Among those favored to finish first is 2007 winner Alberto Contador of Spain, another Astana rider who'd better watch his back just in case Lance Armstrong, technically his teammate, decides to ride over it and take half the Astana team with him. Joining me now to discuss how well Lance Armstrong will adapt to that role of second banana and various other matters related to Mr. Armstrong is John Wilcoxon, the author of a new biography titled Lance. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
I'm pleased to be here. Thank you.
You conclude that after winning the Tour 6 times in a row in 2004, Armstrong had nothing left to prove as an athlete. He rode in and won the Tour again in 2005 in order to publicize his Live Strong Foundation. But why has he come out of retirement to ride in the Tour yet again?
He missed it, basically. He retired in 2005, and when I spoke to him about that, he said that when he gave his farewell speech on the Champs-Élysées, he really meant every word of what he said. He was not going to come back. But over the years, he started to miss being this supreme champion. And last year, he was training, actually, for the Chicago Marathon. And he felt so good doing that that he entered a 100-mile mountain bike race in Colorado and felt really good in that. And he decided, well, I'd like to come back and I'd like to prove myself again. And also, he said he wanted to do for his children. He said he didn't want them to be growing up and searching things on the web and finding Lance Armstrong connected with doping all the time.
Well, that's a fascinating point, because how does one prove in 2009 that there was no previous involvement with doping?
You can't prove a negative, it's true. But he can prove that he's been consistently strong in his whole career as an athlete. Starting at age 13, he was winning triathlons. And he is totally transparent since he announced his return to cycling. He's had some 35 out-of-competition tests by the World Anti-Doping Agency and the US equivalent. And every result is posted on his website. This is the only way he can prove to the world that yes, he's a great athlete, but also he's totally clean.
It occurs to me that if he finishes very poorly in this year's tour, that might sort of backfire on him.
Well, he's already been racing since January. He raced in Australia. He did the Tour of California, where he finished very high up, top five, and helped his teammate Levi Leipheimer win the race. And in the Tour of Italy, which finished 3 weeks ago, again, it's a three-week race, which he rode to warm up for the Tour, and he finished 12th in that without pushing himself. And he'd just come back from breaking his shoulder blade. So I think he's online to do very, very well at the Tour de France.
I'm sure that the team director, Johan Brunel, is delighted to be working with Lance Armstrong again. They had teamed up so successfully for such a long time. But what about Alberto Contador, the Astana team's designated number one rider?
Well, Alberto, he's won the three Grand Tours. Very few people have. He's won the Tour de France, the Tour of Italy, and the Tour of Spain in the past 2 years. And he's obviously an exceptional athlete. He's 26 years old, and he has a lot of ambition, but he also has about another 10 years of his career still to go. Johan, who's worked with Lance for 10 years now and won seven Tours de France with him, he believes that Lance can be such a valuable weapon for the team. People don't know quite what Lance is going to do, so if they're watching Alberto, Lance might go away in a breakaway or an attack, and vice versa. If everyone's watching Lance, Alberto could benefit. It's like having two team leaders, even though Alberto, because he's been racing since Lance retired and has won all these Grand Tours, he's the one who's designated on paper as the team leader.
Two team leaders is a phrase that makes it sound like you won't be surprised if Lance rides to win.
I think that's quite possible. He definitely told me when he called me last August, he said, you know, I want to win the Tour de France again. And I think he very well could. But he's not stupid. He knows the protocol of cycling and he will follow those rules and he'll follow what Johan tells him.
In Lance, your book, you write a great deal about the strategy of riding the Tour de France. I was surprised that at one point during the 99 Tour, Johan told Lance not to win two consecutive stages because if he did, everybody would assume he was cheating by using performance-enhancing substances. Were you surprised by that particular bit of advice?
Well, I was surprised by the revelation that Johan hadn't said that before, but it doesn't surprise me because it was a year after there was scandal after scandal at the Tour de France, headlined by the Festina team, which was thrown out of the race completely. So there was a very sceptical media there. And when Lance won a mountain stage of the Tour, which he'd never done before, everyone shook their heads and said, this is impossible without doping. So it was good advice by Johan to say, you know, don't do it again. You know, we don't need to. We already have the yellow jersey and we're leading the Tour de France. He was leading it by 6 minutes then, so it was very good advice.
You maintain in the book that Lance Armstrong was able to win seven consecutive tours in part because of his exceptional physical gifts, in part because of his extraordinary work ethic, and in part because of, quote, special methods and scientific or technological advancements. What are some of those special methods and advancements?
He had a chiropractor, Dr. Jeff Spencer, who also works with Tiger Woods, and he has cutting-edge methods for recovery using different laser techniques. That is one of the methods. The other one has been in technological advances in bikes and equipment and in his time-trialing bike where he's worked in the wind tunnel for many, many years. So it was both physical and technical advances which he used and still does.
Lance Armstrong prepared for previous tours by riding the whole course in advance, some parts of it more than once. Has he prepared for the 2009 tour as he did for all those others?
He absolutely has, yes. He may not have ridden the whole course, but he doesn't need to because he's raced in the Tour de France. I think it's 11 times now. This year it'll be number 12. And in January, when he went to the south of France for a week or so, he inspected very, very closely this Saturday's Monaco time trial, which is where the race could be won and lost. It's a very vital stage of the race, 15 kilometers long. It goes up to the Moyenne Corniche Road above Monaco and back down to the harbor front. And Lance did that. He told me, he said, I've ridden that 30 or 40 times. I think that shows he's really well prepared. And also this past week, he flew to Switzerland. He rode the stage that finishes at Verbier in Switzerland. And then on Saturday, Sunday, Monday, he rode the stages through the Alps. And also he did the time trial at Annecy. So he's really well prepared for this tour.
On the podium after he won the 2001 tour, Lance Armstrong said, I live the life of an honest man, a happy man, I wouldn't change a thing. But much of what I've read about him makes him sound as if he's obsessed with people who he feels have betrayed him, his stepfather, former teammates who've joined other teams, friends who have turned against him, and he says in some cases lied about him, that sort of thing. Does Lance Armstrong strike you today as a happy man?
He strikes me as a very happy man. I was up in Aspen just before he left for Europe, and his three children were there. They'd been there for something like 3 weeks having fun with their dad, and he just had his new baby with his new partner, Anna Hansen, and he seemed very, very happy. So I think he is. I think he's a happy man.
I don't know if Lance Armstrong can win the Tour de France again, particularly riding at least technically from the number two spot on his team. But I wonder if fans in the U.S. will pay attention to the Tour if Lance isn't leading the race, or at least, as far as they can tell, riding to win.
Well, the public often doesn't read cycling correctly. I can remember talking to Suzanne Halliburton, who's the reporter from the Austin American Statesman from Lance's hometown. She's always used to tell me during the tour, well, Lance is only in seventh place. How can he possibly win? But the Tour de France, the only place that matters is Paris. If you're in Paris and you have the yellow jersey, that's all that counts.
What do you think? Can Lance Armstrong win an eighth Tour de France?
Yes, I think Lance can win an eighth Tour de France. I think it's a very real possibility. Besides his own teammates like Alberto Contador, there's other people he has to beat. But the final week of this year's tour is by far the hardest of the 3 weeks. And those alpine stages which Lance was scouting, and the time trial at Annecy, which comes, I think, 4 days before the finish, I think that is vital. If Lance is wearing the yellow jersey after that time trial, then I think he's answered everybody and he will win the race. And it would be a phenomenal result for his second comeback.
John Wilcoxon is the author of Lance, The Making of the World's Greatest Champion, published by DeCapo. He joined me from KGNU in Boulder, Colorado. John, thanks very much for speaking with me.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Faire du Nord, Paris, Roubaix, Tour de France, Tour de France, la Côte d'Azur et Saint-Tropez.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. And now, more about tennis than you wanted to know. The Williams sisters hate having the grips of their tennis rackets soiled by the sweaty hands of the men who string those rackets. That's according to Roger Dalton, who's in charge of the racket stringing operation that requires 12 racket stringing machines in constant use from 7 a.m. until long after Wimbledon's last match has been decided. But back to the finicky Williams sisters. Roger Dalton doesn't ever want to upset them. We wrap polythene round their grips so the guys don't get their grubby hands on them, says Dalton. The last thing they want is finding somebody's egg sandwich all over their grip. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, are your local teams getting lost among the shrinking sports pages? But first, is anybody else concerned that Wimbledon, the world's most prestigious tennis tournament, has entered the realm of Dr. Seuss meets the Twilight Zone? I mean, in the women's final, it's Williams v. Williams. In one of the men's semifinals, it was Andy v. Andy. Coincidence, or did Andy Williams have something to do with this? You decide. Joining me now from Wimbledon to discuss what's still to come at the tournament is Mr. Tennis, ESPN's Bud Collins. Bud, welcome back to the program.
Bill, glad to be on the show.
Wimbledon is, of course, a place of tradition rather than innovation, but there's a retractable roof over center court now. Has that been a welcome development?
Well, I think for the most part it has been. They've only used it once. There was a little sprinkle, and they decided to close the roof, and then they have a rule that once the roof is closed on a match, it cannot be retracted. Well, the rain stopped very quickly, but they had the local favorite, Andy Murray, playing a Swiss, Stan Wawrinka, and they went five sets, so it ended up as the longest match, or the latest match, I should say, in Wimbledon history, ending at 10:38 p.m. And now the pressure will be to do it every year, a nightly special. And how can the Wimbledon people turn down 15,000 new admissions every night? You know, it used to be that Wimbledon without rain was like vermouth without the gin, but they have banished rain, at least on one court.
Regarding the results in the women's tournament, are you surprised at all that we will see Williams play Williams again this weekend?
No, not at all. They are the class of the field, and it doesn't matter what they're ranked. They are the one to make them co-number one, if you will, players in the game, and they have been for some time. Occasionally you get somebody like Dinara Safina, the Russian, who for some reason the Medusa, the WTA computer, coughed her up as number one. I don't know what the reason is, but poor Dinara, who was beaten by Venus 6-love, 6-1 in the semifinal, ought to sue the computer because it's asking unreal things of her to put her at number one. She should be about number nine.
On the men's side, the rivalry between Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal has become such a prominent subplot. To what extent did the air go out of this year's Wimbledon when Rafael Nadal decided that he couldn't play in the tournament because of a bad knee?
Well, it was a shock, but I think more people were really concerned about his future. He's just a kid, 23, and to have bad knee problems, it's because of the way he plays. It's all crash, bang, slam, and run as hard as you can on every point. And that has taken a toll. And I'm just wondering, and I hope I'm wrong, I'm wondering whether he will be the same Nadal when he returns.
There were lots of stories about how Queen Elizabeth might have made one of her rare appearances at Wimbledon if Andy Murray had made it to the men's final. Was that just too much pressure on Mr. Murray?
Well, she did send him a handwritten note. And I know the Queen has never expressed a preference for tennis. Her father, who became George VI, played Wimbledon in 1926 in the doubles and was atrocious. And I think they even rigged the draw. They put a couple of old men against him and his partner, and they still couldn't win. But the Queen last showed up here in 1977 when Virginia Wade, the last Brit to win the title, won. And that was a very emotional day. The crowd sang to Virginia Wade. They serenaded her with "For She's a Jolly Good Fellow." And the Queen, I think, stayed awake for much of it. She has a way of sitting behind those dark glasses and with erect posture, and I think they probably teach royals that, and they probably sleep most of the way.
But I understand that Andy Roddick has always paid a lot of attention to his conditioning, but recently he's taken that even more seriously.
Yeah, he's advanced it, and he has a new coach, Larry Stefanke, who is one of the best coaches. And even though Andy was fit, Stefanke wanted him to get fitter and take off 15 pounds. And also, he took the play away from Andy Murray. He was serving big, rushing the net, and it just was a marvelous victory for him. And I certainly wouldn't have put him as somebody I expected to see in the final when the tournament began. In fact, my pick was the other Andy. Shame on me.
But given the potential drama of Roger Federer winning this tournament, was anybody rooting for Tommy Haas when those two played?
Well, I was, because Tommy was showing stuff that you don't see very often. He was playing serve and volley much of the time and volleying very well and keeping very close to Federer for the first two sets. He's a very attractive attractive player, and he's had so much bad luck with injuries throughout his career that I was very happy to see him getting this far, and he had won the tournament in Halle, Germany, before this tournament. So he's a good guy, and I was secretly cheering for him.
Well, if he does beat Roddick in the final, Roger Federer will pass Pete Sampras as the all-time champion in terms of Grand Slams won with 15. Would that achievement crown Federer as the greatest male player of his or any other time?
Well, I don't think so, really. First of all, his career is far from over. But look at this. Nadal has the edge on him. How can you be the greatest player in the year of your era if somebody else is beating up on you? But there's no doubt that Roger Federer is an all-time great. But you have to look at players like Rod Laver, who missed 5 years because he was a professional in the days when only the amateurs could play the major championships. And he had 2 Grand Slams. Nobody has ever come close to that. And you look at Kenny Rosewell, Pancho Gonzalez. There were a lot of awfully good players. Federer is a great player. There's no doubt about that.
But I can't leave you without asking for a prediction in the men's final.
Am I allowed to pick Federer? I really think for the first time, you know, Andy Roddick has played and lost to Federer so many times that he stopped counting. But I really do believe he has a chance, and that's the best I can say.
In the employ of ESPN, Bud Collins is once again gracing Wimbledon with his esteemed presence. Bud, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
If you pine for plentiful podcasts, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcasts. With the economy in the tank and more people getting their news online, newspapers are bleeding circulation and revenue at historic rates. In recent weeks, major dailies have been writing, or at least pondering, their own obituaries. The Rocky Mountain News scuttled its presses in February. The Seattle Post-Intelligencer slashed staff and went all digital in March. And the Boston Globe has faced threats of closure since April. But news staffers aren't the only ones hurting. When newspapers close or shrink, sports fans suffer too, with less coverage, fewer voices, and limited access to the teams they love. What happens when the sports page disappears? Keith O'Brien has our story.
Scorecard program, only $2. Red Sox, Sylvania game programs, only $2. Get a free bumper sticker.
It's game time at Fenway Park on a recent night. Red Sox versus Yankees. The streets teem with fans and the press box bustles with sports writers, including Gordon Eads, a writer with more than 3 decades of newspaper experience. He started as a copy boy for the Chicago Tribune in 1972, which makes him not just old school, but sort of old. Eads is 54, and yet the blue-eyed sports writer is also 21st century savvy. Last summer, he left the Boston Globe, where he'd been a Red Sox beat writer for 12 years, to become a national baseball writer for Yahoo Sports, you know, the website. He took the job, he says, for the opportunity to go national.
And also because, as with many in my profession, we did sense that that's where the business was going, to the net. And I was hugely grateful for the opportunity to be part of that movement.
In hindsight, Eads looks something like a genius. Between the sputtering economy and newspapers' inability to develop a profitable business model for the internet age, major metropolitan dailies are struggling like never before. And just as these events are affecting news reporters, they're affecting sports reporters, who often have fewer pages to fill now, smaller budgets for travel, or increasingly, no job at all. Sports reporters have been laid off in recent weeks from Baltimore to Los Angeles. And yet, you won't find Gordon Eads gloating, because he knows the truth. No one covers a team like a newspaper beat writer. And when that person is gone, it's the fan who loses.
There are situations like in San Diego, which is essentially a one newspaper town, and they laid off their Padres beat writer, which is extraordinary to me. I think in some ways what it means is that there's a certain degree of expertise that fans no longer will have access to.
Though fans have never had greater access to the teams and players they love via websites, blogs, Twitter feeds, and 24/7 television coverage, some cities have fewer sports writers in the press box on a nightly basis than ever before. And readers are now missing out on some pretty interesting agate-type rivalries. Until this spring, the Denver Post and Rocky Mountain News waged a daily battle over sports, sometimes literally.
I had a fistfight in the press box one night between a writer from the Post and a writer for the Rocky Mountain News. That's how competitive it was in this town.
That's Jay Alvis, Vice President of Communications and Public Relations for the Colorado Rockies. He can't remember what the fight was over or how it ended, but he does recall that the competition between the Rocky and the Post drove coverage, which in turn drove interest, and that, says Alvis, was good for fans, the Rockies franchise, and the papers that covered it.
When I arrived here in Denver in 98, we had two beat writers from both newspapers covering the club, which was unheard of. Not just covering the club at home, but also on the road. They traveled, two beat writers, and send the columnists, and it was a major doing in town.
When the Rocky Mountain News shut down last February, Denver sports teams lost a conduit to their fans. 200,000 subscribers, some of whom read the sports page every day, were gone overnight. There's now just one newspaper beat reporter regularly covering the Rockies this summer, Alvis says. And while some people don't seem worried about that, they should be, says Barry Forbes, the former sports editor of the Rocky.
What they're not getting is that news that they're reading on the web, whether it's ESPN or Yahoo, that news that they're getting is usually coming from a newspaper. That's where it all starts. They're the news organizations that have people dedicated, you know, to each of these teams. Mike Shanahan getting fired, Jay Cutler asking to be traded, demanding to be traded. You know, those kind of stories, you may have thought you heard them on the radio first, and you know, maybe you did, but they came out first from a newspaper.
It's not that national outlets like ESPN don't cover the Broncos. Of course they do, says Forbes.
But they don't cover the Broncos the way the Denver Post covers the Broncos, or the way the Rocky Mountain News used to cover the Broncos. They have one guy covering the AFC West. And, you know, we had 3 and 4 and 5 and some days 6 and 7 and 8 people covering one team in the AFC West. So that kind of scrutiny you only get from a newspaper.
Forbes, a father of three, is looking for work now, and he has plenty of company. Few, however, have a story quite like David Steele's. As a sports columnist for the Baltimore Sun, Steele was covering an Orioles game at Camden Yards in late April when he got a call in the press box from his editor. The news? Steele was being laid off, effective immediately. And that's when it hit him. This might be the end.
I just thought, it's like, there is no other job to go to. There aren't going to be other openings. There isn't anybody else going to be out there hiring. I mean, this really might be the end of my newspaper career. That really shook me up, and it's like, this is all I've wanted to do since like freshman year in high school, and this could be the last time I work for a newspaper ever. And it was just really scary and really depressing.
Steele, who's 44, thinks he'll be all right. He's well known in Baltimore. He's landed some freelance gigs in recent weeks, and he still appears as a regular guest on the local Fox radio affiliate. David Steele, the newspaper man, has become a talking head. Still, he's worried about the future of his craft. At this point, only one thing seems certain. More layoffs are probably coming sometime soon to a press box near you. For Only a Game, I'm Keith O'Brien.
You're listening to Only a Game. In a game against the Braves at County Stadium in Milwaukee on April 30th, 1961, Willie Mays hit 4 home runs. This did not surprise me. At 13, I was well aware that Willie Mays was the greatest baseball player of all time and that he would remain so. For the record, nothing since then has shaken that conviction. On that April day 48 years ago, the New York World Telegram and Sun, the paper my father read on the train each evening as he returned home from work and handed to me as he came through our front door, covered Willie's achievement as if Willie and the Giants were still playing in New York. The homers were celebrated in bold type at the top of the sports page, never mind that the Giants had moved to San Francisco before the 1958 season began. Now, of course, young fans of any ball player who bopped four home runs in a game would learn of the feat instantly via whatever technology they preferred. A favorite website, the excited tweet of some lucky fellow fan present for the event, perhaps a handheld device programmed to ring, vibrate, or shoot off fireworks whenever something out of the ordinary occurred at any ballpark anywhere. But in 1961, when the doings of the team that I continued to follow faithfully despite their relocation were reported in full each day by a daily paper in the city the Giants had forsaken, I was grateful. How else, when I was away in Maine at summer camp in 1960, would I have learned that the Giants had brought up a right-handed pitcher with a magnificently, if absurdly flamboyant, windup named Juan Marichal? Some of the baseball writers thought he might do the ball club some good. I sat on my bunk during rest period and read the clippings my parents had sent me, and I hoped those writers would be proven right. As it turned out, they would be, but I suppose that is beside the point, which is that for those of us of a certain age, the baseball writing of newspaper reporters and columnists attached to a team, even if only by the team's past and the echoes in its empty stadium, was significant. That's not to say those times were better, and certainly the 12- and 13-year-old baseball fans of today are more quickly and more thoroughly informed than I was then. But in this time of dwindling newspapers, those clips about two of the Giants of my childhood seemed worth a mention.
His Uncle Sam, he left the Giants in an awful jam. But now he's back, and he's Leo's joy. And Willie's still a growing boy. Say hey,
say who?
Say Willie, say hey,
say who?
Swinging at the plate, say hey,
say who?
Say Willie, that Giants kid is great. That Giants kid is great. Say Willie, what you gonna say?
Say hey.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
For years, St. Mary's Church in Wimbledon Village has utilized the world's most famous tennis tournament as a fundraiser. For £20, patrons of the tournament have been allowed to park their cars on the graves of people whose descendants could not be traced. The fees went to various charities. This year, however, somebody handling the parking franchise became a bit eager. Drivers were directed into what the church has acknowledged were the wrong places. Melanie Alcock of Balham reported that she was told to leave her car between two gravestones. I thought, this is very odd, she said. But we did it and went to Wimbledon. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, New York, New York. If you can catch fish there, you can catch them anywhere. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill, and hello to our new friends at WKAR, 870 AM in East Lansing, Michigan. Roll on through for MSU. Watch the points keep growing.
Nicely
Spartan
done.
Spartan teams. That's as far as I get.
I hope anybody's still listening.
Thank you.
The Tour de France gets underway today, and the 2007 champion Alberto Contador seems to be well-supported. Johan Brunel, who's been behind eight Tours de France wins, will be Contador's general manager, and some guy named Armstrong will be riding as one of his domestiques. How do you think that's going to work out?
Well, I think he's going to be the most closely watched competitor in the history of this race.
Meanwhile, a French arbitration court has cleared the way for Belgian rider Tom Boonen to ride in this year's Tour despite a positive test for cocaine in April. Wine laced with cocaine was apparently the drink of choice during the Tour's early days. Do you think Mr. Boonen was just trying to keep that tradition alive?
Now, I suspect the wine part of it probably wasn't featured in Mr. Boonen's training regimen. I remember the stories of them giving, like, diluted arsenic to people when they were running the marathon.
There was that, yes.
Yeah.
Scotsman Andy Murray lost to American Andy Roddick yesterday, but not before a lot of people made a whole lot of money on the mere possibility that a Brit would make the men's final at Wimbledon for the first time since 1938. What do you think, Charlie? Would you have paid £20,000 for the privilege of seeing that little piece of history?
I wouldn't even lose £20,000 to watch that little piece of history. However, I mean, this is an interesting question. Is Andy Murray really British? I mean, it's one thing for the British public, desperate to win at anything, to grab onto him. But isn't he a Scot?
He's
and
a
wouldn't
Scot.
He wouldn't he find that somewhat, you know, long Shanksian of them?
You know, another scandal is not what we need here.
I'm just saying. I think that we've got to check. We ought to check with Andy as to whether or not he feels like he wants to be the, you know, the British homecoming hero.
The Williams sisters will face each other once again in the women's final at Wimbledon. Any idea of which one will prevail this time around?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to tell with these two. They're both playing very, very well. Serena's playing extraordinarily well. Her match with Elena Dementieva is going to go down in history as one of the great non-finals in the history of the tournament. I think Serena will prevail because I think she's a little bit healthier than her sister.
As we speak, Major League Baseball teams are busy bidding on the guy many scouts call, I'm quoting now, the best left-handed pitching prospect in the world. Arnoldus Chapman defected from the Cuban national team, a challenge that doesn't seem quite as challenging as it once did.
Well, apparently he caught a cab in Rotterdam. They were playing over there. The Cuban team was playing there over there in a tournament, and he apparently just walked out of the hotel and never came back.
He caught a cab and said, take me to the Yankees?
He caught a cab and said, take me to an agent's office very quickly.
Baseball is no stranger to rain delays, especially here in New England, where we just had one of the cloudiest and rainiest Junes on record. But, Charlie, have you ever seen a baseball game delayed because of bees?
No, but I would delay a baseball game because of bees. I mean, a swarm of bees in a stadium can be a very, very ugly thing. Apparently, Houston was beating San Diego and wound up beating them 7-2. But for 52 minutes, they had to wait before these bees went. In fact, there's several players, including Kyle Blanks from San Diego, who are allergic to bee stings, so this is really no joke. But I think it's just, you know, another example that, you know, God is not real happy with the way baseball's been going these days.
He's sending bees.
He's sending little messengers, yes. Flocks of little messengers.
Ron Artest announced on Thursday that he will become a member of the Los Angeles Lakers. Good fit, huh?
This is an interesting one because, number one, he will make them a much better team. Training camp will become a fascinating place. Number two, he and Kobe Bryant have had more than their share of run-ins playing against each other. I think of all the post-draft deals by the teams that will be competitive for the NBA title next year, I think this is the best one.
The Detroit Pistons, meanwhile, are looking for a new head coach for the fourth time in six seasons. Michael Curry is the latest casualty. Isn't this a little bit like taking a player out of the game the first time he misses a shot?
I don't know. Joe Dumars is a very admirable guy, and he's done a great job as the general manager in Detroit, but he is having real trouble keeping a coach. And pretty soon that's going to really come back and tear this franchise up.
Let me see if I've got this one straight, Charlie. Kansas University almost lost its most promising recruit, Xavier Henry, after the Kansas City Star accurately quoted Xavier's father as saying, if he didn't have to go to college, he wouldn't do it. Since when is it a scandal to accurately report on an accurate statement?
I have no idea. I mean, this is a tremendously complicated story. This guy's a terrific recruit. There was some talk about him going to Memphis. John Calipari leaves. He goes to Kansas. Maybe he doesn't go to Kansas. His father says something purely accurate, and I might add something I would agree with. If none of these guys had to go for a year, none of them would. Now everything's settled down, and he actually texts a local radio station saying that he's going to stay and play with the Jayhawks. So there's modern media is tied up in this, too.
How'd you like to be his academic advisor?
You wouldn't need to be. Actually, it would be a very easy job.
This week, the Chicago Blackhawks signed winger Marian Hossa to a 12-year contract. This is an awfully long contract for a guy who's 30 years old, but I don't imagine he'll actually play the whole thing.
Well, we know one thing for sure. The Chicago Blackhawks have no chance of winning next year's Stanley Cup because this guy is the ancient mariner. This is the guy, this is the guy who left Pittsburgh to go to Detroit and then promptly was on the team that lost to Pittsburgh. So I'm sorry, Blackhawks. You'll be waiting another year.
Details have emerged this week from the forthcoming David Beckham biography by Sports Illustrated's Grant Wall. Were you shocked to learn that some of Beckham's teammates on the LA Galaxy would not be so sad to see Mr. Posh Spice go away?
Landon Donovan of the Confederation Cup runners-up has really dropped a bomb on Mr. Beckham, saying he didn't work real hard. Gee, surprise me. He came over here for the paycheck. He was hired to be a kind of walking terrarium exhibit for the MLS, and that's what he did. He did everything but hand him an organ and a monkey in a little suit. It was an experiment. It sort of worked. It sort of didn't. We're all moving on now.
Mr. NASCAR, I know you think Halls of Fame should open their doors and let everybody in, but the NASCAR Hall of Fame has decided that their inaugural class can only hold five. How do they make the picks?
First of all, are you surprised that NASCAR's only just now getting around to having a Hall of Fame?
I am shocked.
I mean, I thought they would be one of the first sports that would put one of these together. I think it can pretty much make Junior Johnson and Richard Petty locks. You know, Bill France Sr., who's essentially invented NASCAR, will probably make the Hall of Fame. So there's three. Now you got a bunch of people fighting for two spots. It'll be interesting to see if Richard Petty gets in and Lee Petty doesn't.
And finally, Charlie, what did you think of the end zone tribute that Toronto Argos receiver Arlen Bruce offered up to deceased pop star Michael Jackson?
First of all, let's give our listeners, especially our new listeners in East Lansing, a test. Did he, A, put on a white glove, B, moonwalk, C, shake his booty, or D, lie down like a dead person? saying he took off his helmet and shoulder pads and his uniform top and laid down in the end zone and said he was honoring Jackson's memory by pretending to be buried.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do we know he wasn't honoring, like, you know, James Garfield or
Abraham Lincoln,
you know, other famous dead people?
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. His newest book is Idiot America. I think he has a new idiot to put in it. Anyway, he joins me each week on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You can take a closer listen to this week's stories, find a link to our weekly podcasts, or peruse our archives by visiting our website at onlyagame.org. If you happen to be driving along one of Long Island's many parkways and notice a heavily mustachioed fellow hauling heavy striped bass from beneath a bridge, there's a good chance you're witnessing the handiwork of angling legend Billy Lagakis. Only a Game's John Kalish tailed Lagakis during some of his more recent fishing expeditions and reeled in the legend of Billy the Greek.
One day I walked past a fishing store in my neighborhood here in Manhattan and noticed a large book poster in the window. There was a picture of a guy with his back to the camera and two 30-pound stripers slung over his shoulder as he walked along a narrow bridge late at night. The book is called Night Tides, and it was written by Mike Cinquemani, a retired public school administrator. Back in 1968, Cinquemani was just starting his career as a junior high school teacher. That's when he ran into a Long Island teenager named Billy Lagakis. A 40-year friendship and apprenticeship ensued.
One day he approached me with his great powers of perception. He'd see me come home with a fishing rod, but never with any fish. And the little wise ass says, "I see you're always going fishing. I never saw you with a fish yet. What do you do, release them all?"
The kid started trading his fishing knowledge for rides to fishing spots, and Cinquemani started catching fish. As a teenager, Billy Lagakis worked at a local bait shop on Long Island's South Shore, where he came in contact with local experts who closely guarded their knowledge of how to bag the big bass. This was in the late 1960s and early 70s, during the heyday of recreational striped bass fishing. During that time, the kid got to hang around the pinhookers, commercial fishermen who caught stripers with just a rod and hook. Again, author Mike Cinquemani.
He became very, very skillful at a very early age. I would say by the time Billy was 15, he was holding his own against these legends of striped bass fishing. They were known for their ability to go out and catch striped bass, the likes of which very, very few people ever saw. And sometimes they'd take him out with them on their boats. Sometimes Billy would outfish the pros.
Legakis also learned to hunt the big bass from bridges near Long Island's beaches from an old man he says he shadowed for a long time. The teenager was rebuffed on his initial approach, but eventually the old guy relented.
He goes, listen, kid, he goes, this is a limited market. He goes, if you're smart, you'll shut your mouth and learn how to do this. He goes, if you tell anyone, they all have brothers, sisters, uncles, and cousins that'll come up here and do this. And that's about all he said.
The fishing phenom, who became known as Billy the Greek, only cares about stripers. The Greek, as close associates call him, is in his mid-50s and sports a bushy Fu Manchu mustache. He reveres Marone saxatilis and only keeps the bass that he plans to eat. Over the years, he's said to have caught close to 3,000 stripers that weigh more than 20 pounds. But it's the monsters that he loves to pursue. The Greek has reeled in 4 stripers that weighed in excess of 60 pounds. In a sport where serious bass fishermen go a lifetime without bagging a single 50-pound striper, Billy the Greek caught 4 of them in one night. Author Mike Cinquemani was a witness to that feat.
Because he's a pain in the ass, and because he's an arrogant guy at times, and because he lies like a rug, which is what you have to do when you're a good fisherman, some people resent him. And also, a lot of people think he exaggerates, that it's not humanly possible to produce the numbers of fish that he does. And I can understand that reaction. I would think he's full of crap, too, if I didn't see it with my own eyes.
The Greek has gotten so well known in these parts that he's gone to great lengths to disguise himself and keep his whereabouts a secret. He usually fishes after dark or in the very early morning hours. A house painter by profession, Billy the Greek has been known to drop his paintbrushes and pick up his rod when he gets word that the bass are biting. Late on a weeknight in autumn, Billy the Greek drives his van to a series of small bridges that connect 2 major parkways to Jones Beach on the south shore of Long Island, about 30 miles east of Manhattan.
We got 9 bridges in a 3 or 4 mile span, so you can really cover a lot of territory quickly. And they're good bridges. 3 of them are right by an inlet. It don't get a whole lot better than that.
Billy the Greek parks his van along the side of the parkway so it's obscured by high grasses. Fishing off these bridges is illegal. The cat and mouse game he plays with state police and local bay constables can often result in a $50 fine. He hurries onto a narrow walkway over the bridge, hoping to spot large bass in the shadows created by the bridge and the bright lights from the parkway. Billy the Greek cups his hands over his eyes and scans the water below, looking for stripers. To the uninitiated, it seems like a futile task, but the Greek has no trouble seeing the black velvet shadow of the bass in the dark bay waters. He explains the bass lurk in the shadows, waiting for bait fish to swim by.
That's their ambush point. They can see into the light with the bait, and the bait can't see into the dark, so perfect. They stay with their nose right on the line somewhere, like glued. It looks like they nailed to the water. It's amazing to see a fish that doesn't move and stays put.
Despite his rep as one of the best fishermen in the tri-state area, the first night I went fishing with Billy the Greek, neither he nor a couple of fishing buddies he ran into caught any fish.
All right, boys, have we had enough of this garbage?
So this spring, I joined Billy the Greek on the north shore of Long Island. The day before the Memorial Day weekend, the Greek and his friend Andrew Swiller fished Long Island Sound from a private beach near the city of Glencoe.
Not a lot of water here, boy. That sinker hits quick. I bet you it's about 4 feet, 5 feet of water out there.
There was hardly any weight before the bite began.
Fish on.
It was after 10 p.m. and the tide was going out quickly. The two stood on the dark shore without any man-made light.
Oh, see him there? Look at that. Hear him splashing up that water? There he is. Oh, that's a bass. Nice bass.
Yeah.
Good bass.
Nice fish, right?
Oh, yeah.
It was a 30-pound bass that measured 40 inches.
That fish fought good. The big bass have a lot of punch. They just keep pulling. They don't give up until, you know, you got to get them out of the water. That was a lot of fun.
That bass was not alone. So where's the rest of the school?
He's right here.
Fish on.
And so it went that night.
Whoa, Bill, you see this one?
Many bluefish were caught and promptly released back into the Sound. Two of the bass were kept, one of which graced the table at Billy the Greek's Memorial Day barbecue. Another rode into Manhattan with this reporter on the Long Island Railroad. I returned to my loft at 3 a.m., where two Siamese cats were extremely excited to see an 11-pound striper loaded into the fridge. For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish in New York. I'm going fishing, I'm going fishing. Oh, no, 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 no. Now, sir, I don't care what the boss man do. I'm going fishing, I'm going fishing. Let me tell all of you now, I got a mess of them fishing man blues. Now look at him, honey.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trevoux. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Josh Levenshurs. We had help this week from Karen Schiffman and from Evan Perkins at KGNU in Boulder, Colorado. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our Billy the Greek photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, learn more about the music you hear on our program, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from the legend himself, Billy the Greek Lagakis.
All right, boys, have we had enough of this garbage?
Hey, watch it there, Billy. You're referring to this program, I refuse to take the bait. All right, enough fishing for compliments. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. I got a hand for him slam under. Lord have mercy. I'm gonna tell you now, we flat show doing some fishing. I got a mess of them fishing man blues. Oh, yeah.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.